All right, let's get this meeting started in the right way. Everyone will join me. We'll have a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We're going to skip right to the meat and potatoes of this deal, and I believe Felicia is going to come up and read how it works. All right.
Hello, everyone. I'm Felicia, and I am an alcoholic. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easy, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideals, and the results were nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. With help, it is too much for us. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection with care and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took to suggest as the program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us have been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description to the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And see that God could and would if he were sought.
What a beautiful job Felicia did reading how it works. I believe now we're getting ready for Olga, and I think David A. is going to introduce her.
David Anderson, alcoholic. Sobriety dates June 18th to 92, and there are a bunch of people in my life grateful for that. A lot of people in this room. When they asked me to find a couple of speakers from Waco, today's two speakers were the first two that pretty much popped into my mind. And Olga, I met her 3 or 4 years ago, maybe five, Heart of Texas Conference. She was working registration, and I gave her a little help, and we did a lot of talking and have just shared a lot of stuff in the program since. And is just a really neat lady. She's got a good program. She's a hard worker. I use this term, I hadn't heard it in a long time, but I used it the other night, and I think it applies to her. Olga's a member of AA in good standing, as far as I can see. And I had some old-timers that used to introduce themselves that way, and to me that's pretty important. And I think she's going to come up here and tell us just how good a program she's got. Olga, come on up.
Hey guys, my name is Olga Rogers and I am an alcoholic. And is this microphone okay? Because it's right in my sight of vision and that's not okay. Is that okay? You guys can hear me? Okay. It is truly through the grace of my higher power. It is because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's because of the solution for recovery that's outlined in that big book we called Alcoholics Anonymous that I do have contented sobriety today. I've had the gift of sobriety since March 15th of 2000. I am truly, truly grateful for that. And when I got here, if you guys had said, what do you want out of AA or any of that stuff, there's just no way that I would have had any of the things that I enjoy today. And I want to preface this because I get excited and everything and carried away. But I want to preface at this moment that I know that everything in my life is truly a gift from my higher power. And I also want to say that my higher power, whom I choose to call God, runs my life. Olga does not. So when I say I or something, please just substitute G-O-D. That's my higher power. But before I go and share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, if you will let me have a moment of silence, because I have to quietly ask my God to come in and let him talk through me. Put Olga's ego to the side. All that I think I should be telling you guys today, just put it all to the side and let my God just come on in and do the talking. So just a moment of silence, just for a minute, please. Okay, again, my name is Olga Rogers, and I'm still an alcoholic, y'all. Nothing changed in those few seconds. Hi, guys. I do want to say thank you to the Meridian Group for asking me to come down and share my story. You've got some pretty awesome people in your group. You almost look like humility. I mean, almost all the faces that I've seen here, I've seen in service at the area level and everything. And so I know that Meridian Group is going to continue to grow because you've got people that do things. And I've learned this little short time that I've been in these rooms that if we don't step up to the plate and if we don't do the do, Alcoholics Anonymous won't be here. At least it won't be as it should be as far as traditions go. Okay, here comes my dirt. So I will share a bit of my story with you. I am a native Texan. I'm born and raised in Corpus Christi. And I don't have anything really exciting to share about the dysfunctional family and, you know, daddy beat mom and the dog ran away and all those other good things. I will say that I have a stepdad in my life who my mother married, God, when I was very young, but I was a big girl, 7, 8, I don't know how old now. And when he came into our family, he did have a drinking problem. And it was short-lived, obviously, because my mother, he tells the story that he was a mail carrier. And he tells a story that he would find these pamphlets, you know, the 44 questions around the house. And he kept thinking, I don't remember putting those in boxes today, like the junk mail and stuff. And they just kept popping up. And he says, I wonder if that's coming through the mail. But the bottom line is that my mother cared enough for this man to find out something from this fellowship. And she politely put the little pamphlets around. And My dad has a sobriety date of October of 1959. So Alcoholics Anonymous, yeah, for real. I am very grateful for that. And that tells me, well, I know today that Alcoholics Anonymous has been in my life. It was very, very short-lived. I have, like, that much memory of any things that alcohol could do to a family because he sobered up really soon after he and my mother married. My mother and my dad, and when I say dad, I am talking about my stepfather, so I don't want to clarify, don't have to clarify that anymore. They did all that they could do and all that, for a little girl like myself. I'm an only child. I do have a half-sister, 14 years older than me, but we were not raised together. Since I've been grown, we have kind of gotten together or whatever. But so I was raised an only child, and I am not spoiled. And any of you or my friends that would beg to differ, just be quiet. But anyway, so my dad spoiled me, my mom, and they afforded me the best living that they could. I will say, too, that being born at the time that I was born right at the tail end of segregation. And I share that not raising my fist and black power and da-da-da-da-da, but I know that that era and that time, and because of my upbringing, it did have an influence on me. And I know that. And so I have to share that with you guys. I was afforded the best education. I went to Catholic school. One of the guys in my home group says I'm a recovering Catholic, although today I can appreciate Catholicism. But I went to Catholic school all my life, graduated from high school Catholic, and then I went to Baylor University, good old Southern Baptist. So you go figure back in that day. But I say that because at that time, integration, actually schools were not even integrated at the time when I was being raised. They integrated somewhere around high school. I don't remember when. But I got to go to the Catholic school, and I was the only black child, African American, Negro, whatever we were back in the day. I was the only one there looking like me, okay? Bunch of Hispanics in Corpus Christi. The color was there, but that was about all that there was there. So that kind of put me in the middle of two different worlds. I was educated in the Caucasian world, if you please, and I lived in the black community. So I kind of was like a fish out of water. When I'd go to school, I didn't have any real close friends because it wasn't okay. I had a couple friends, but it wasn't okay to have someone that was black to be your friend, to come to sleep over and those kinds of things. So I had acquaintances at school, and being an only child, number one, and then number two, not going to school with my neighbors, I didn't quite have a close friend there either. So books were my best friends. My mom was my best friend. And that was kind of how I rolled along. And I was a happy kid. Now, I'm not saying this to bring out violins and all. I was a very happy child. When I was 16, God saw fit to take my mother. My mother died. She was 40 years old. She died in November 1965, and at December she would have been 41. It was a sudden death, unexpected, some type of a virus or something that she contracted just during that week, the week of Thanksgiving. And that just kind of flipped my little life all the way around because, number one, my mom's my best friend. And number two, I am now a young girl at 16 with the only caretaker, if you please, my dad, who happened to be my stepdad. And I didn't know that it wasn't okay for a 16-year-old young lady to live in the house with a stepdaddy. I mean, I'd never had any issues, but for the grace of God, I've never been abused, sexually abused, and all those other good things. So I didn't know all those things. I have an aunt, and she is truly a big part of my story, and all of you guys that have sat in meetings with me in Waco have heard the aunt story all the way from learning how to deal with her all the way to her death 2 years ago. Well, God, 04, 3 years ago now. But anyway, so when my mother passed, we came to Waco, buried her because Waco is home for my mother's family and everything, and it kind of happened that I didn't get to go back to Corpus Christi to live. I now need to be in Waco with my aunt. I'm very grateful. My mama's oldest sister, she just stepped right in. I never missed a beat as far as having a mom or a mama figure in my life. And so I didn't know I wasn't going to go back to Corpus. I mean, they gently told me these things as we were whipping along and having funerals and all this other good stuff, which also meant that I wasn't going back to the high school that I was going to, all girls Catholic high school in Corpus, and I had one or two of those acquaintances. And I am now to live in Waco, Texas. And in a sense, I was in culture shock because I am now fixing to live, go to Catholic High, Riker Catholic High, yay Cougars. It is a co-ed high school. There was one black guy at the school, a year older than me. He was an Air Force kid, James Connolly Air Force Base at that time. So he was a student there, but he was a grade over me. So, of course, there was no bonding. So here I am with my little black behind up in the middle of all these people. And there were boys, guys. I wasn't dealing with boys at that time. I was in an all-girls Catholic high. So I'm in shock there. I'm coming to Central Texas, and I've learned to love Waco at this point. Okay. Honest program. But it's a little bit different. And the racial thing in that day, I'll be nice and not say today, but in that day, was very, very different. Corpus Christi, predominantly Hispanic, less than 3% black population, probably less than 1% at that time, black population. So whatever the racial mess was going on, I didn't get to feel that kind of stuff there because, well, one, I was a very sheltered young lady, but two, it just kind of, they all did what they had to do, and I just kind of floated along. But when I came to Waco, I was hit in the face blatantly with a lot of racial kinds of things, and I was not quite ready for that. And my family never raised me or brought me up to think that I was anything other than an African-American young lady. And I was encouraged to do my best. I come from a family of well-educated people and professionals, and those were the messages given to me. However, that blatant stuff just kind of hit me in the face when I got to Waco. Also, as I said, I was being raised Catholic, and I was very devoted to my faith at that time. And I'm going to a Catholic high school, and the racism kind of jumped out in the middle of Mass and communion and things, you know, people calling you ugly names as they hold the communion plate thing. I've forgotten the name of it now. As you're receiving communion and the altar boy is mouthing the N-word at you. I mean, I was just totally devastated. It was the middle of my junior year in high school. So I think at that point, I just kind of had to pull in. I became very independent within myself. My mother, as she raised me, she always said, you know, Olga, get a good education and be an independent young lady because you never know what husband you might have or whatever, what might happen, but be able to take care of you and your children if something were to happen. So that was kind of the message she'd given me. And trust me, when I got to Waco and things were weird and stuff, I kicked into very much independent young lady. I'm being in the house of my aunt and uncle that were just beautiful, beautiful people. But I didn't want to be a burden. I didn't know I had all these kind of crazy thoughts then, but I didn't want to be a burden to them. I wanted to be the very best that I could be. I was very grateful to be in their home. All that kind of stuff was kicking in then, and I was 16 years old when all that stuff started kicking in. So I just did what I had to do. I was also very challenged because academically was the one way that that's what was okay for me. That's what helped Olga soothe Olga. God gave me a half a piece of brain, and I was just a half, y'all. But I was able to use that, and I did well in academics. But when I came up to Waco to go to Riker, same curriculum, little bit different place in the studies, all of a sudden I'm struggling. And I was in classes, you know, the chemistries, the advanced math, the calculus and all of that. And then you trying to struggle to keep up on top of that. And then you're getting this message that you people are not as good as and all of that. It was a very challenging time for me. But I hung on. So anyway, I finished high school and it was time to go to college. Now, at this point, I'm not drinking. I'm not drugging. Didn't even know nothing about all that good stuff, actually. I've since heard that there was marijuana around back in that day. I didn't know they had marijuana then. I was so doofus. I'd have probably went straight to somebody and told it or something, got beat up about it. I don't know. But I was kind of Miss Goody Two-Shoes. That's just who I was at that time. So anyway, I finished high school, And I wanted to be a doctor. And I wanted to go to University of Texas because UT had a good med school. But my aunt said, because it was so soon after my mother's death, that she wanted me to stay and go to Baylor because that was there in Waco. They could be supportive. So I said, okay, so here I go off again. Olga's doing what other folks want. And I'm very grateful for all this, that I had people that cared about me. So I go trotting off to Baylor University. Here we go again. The message is that you're not as good as. You got to struggle a little bit harder, all this other good stuff. When I went to Baylor, there were 6 black women and 12 black gentlemen. The population was 6,000. And they were not federally funded, so they could take who they wanted to, and they made that very clear. But I went to school there, and it was kind of a struggle. A lot of the classes and stuff and things were such that do projects with your classmates. They all got A's. Olga got a B. Professor says, well, you know, you people have a hard time, and those kinds of things. But I kept going and persevered. I did change my major from pre-med. And I know today it was a God thing, but one of the reasons is that at that time, having difficulty just being there, not being able to stay in the dormitory because I happened to have a Coppertone tan at the time, those guys, boy, y'all just, not that I have any resentments. I honestly don't. I'm grateful for every experience I've had. But I ended up changing my major because I knew that the chemistry, those big classes were the ones that they weed people out. And I just thought, well, you know what? If I'm in this class and I possibly have got 3 strikes against me already, it would be kind of swimming up a stream. So God kind of guided me over to the communication disorders, speech and hearing, audiology and all that. And so I fell in love with that, and that's what I do today. I'm a speech pathologist, audiologist, talking and hearing, that's what I do today. But anyway, so that was a God thing. So anyway, I get through Baylor University, do what I need to do. I'm still pretty much a loner, still no drinking. I was scared to drink, to be honest, and I didn't care for alcohol. I think the message or the word alcoholic was in the back of my head, just being raised with and around my dad or whatever. And nobody preached to me, but I just didn't have any desire for any of that. So I went off and did what I did. But during this, I didn't quite mention that between the age of 20 and 30, I kind of got married like 3 times, you know. I didn't know that you could date a dude and tell him to go away. You know, well, I date him. We kind of kiss. So I guess we better hurry up and get married, or I'm going to go to hell because, you know, this is almost premarital stuff here. So let's get married real quick, and then life is okay. So literally, I did marry, and four to 4.5 years was my number. When that clock started hitting 4.5, I just like, chung, later. So that's kind of what happened. My second marriage, which was 4 years, how long was it? 4 years, 11 months, and some days. I told that dude, I got to go. No, I'm sorry, 3 years, 11. I almost stayed 4 years, y'all. I got to go. But anyway, out of that particular marriage, I did have a son. I have 1 son. My son is 30 years old today. He's a beautiful young man. And it was an abusive marriage. That particular gentleman decided that he was an outdoorsman. I was stuck in Minnesota, me, him, and his guns. So, and all my family was in Texas. It's like, I did some stupid stuff, y'all. No, some naive things back in the day. But anyway, but he ended up being an abusive guy. Intelligent, very professional man. We owned the only electrical contracting company in the Midwest 5-state area. Oh, everything looked lovely on the outside. But every once in a while, dude get upset about something, and guess who got it? Then he claimed, well, he was a Vietnam vet, so I don't know. He said he stayed underwater in that submarine too long. Whatever it was, brother wasn't wrapped real tight. So every about 7 to 8 months or so, he'd go off the deep end. And he wasn't a drink. I mean, he drank, but he was not an alcoholic. He didn't do any of that. He was just a deranged person. So anyway, I kind of got tired of being the target. I got tired of being threatened with these guns. And I was also raising a male child. And I thought to myself, now, you know, I gave birth to this little boy here, and he's seeing this treatment of me as a female by this crazy man here. And if he gets older and starts talking smack to me, I might have to be coming before the judicial system, because I was going to wipe his ass out. Okay? As I've heard said, I brought you here, brought you in the world, and I can take you out. So anyway, I had the, thank goodness, I had the good sense to get away. I left. My son was about 2 years, 9 months, who's counting, and I left Minnesota and left that crazy man. But anyway, I've got a beautiful son today. We've got a beautiful rapport, and because of this program, I give him a lot of AA stuff when he calls. We talk almost every day. I mean, we're just really close. Every once in a while, my son will call and say, well, Mom, I just wanted to run this past you, whatever it is, and I'll give him a solution that you guys have taught me how to do. Once or twice, he'll call and he says, you know, I think I'm going to do that AA thing. And I'm like, what is that, babe? Well, I'm going to be still, or I know first things first. I mean, he just starts rattling off all these things, so I guess I've used it on the poor child. But anyway, so anyway, from 20 to 30, I'm just trying to be a professional woman, a mom, all of that. At the age of 30, I married for the last time, and that gentleman is dad. He was stepdad to my son, and that's the dad that my son relates to. And but all that time now, y'all, I'm not drinking, right? I don't like alcohol. I don't like any of this crazy stuff. So I get around 30. I kind of dipped a little bit with that left-hand illegal tobacco that they grow sometimes, and they like to say it's not legal to do it, you know. So I enjoyed that a time or two. But when I got 30 and I married my last husband, one of the attractions was that he was quite skilled at rolling those unmarked cigarettes, if you please. So with that, I mean, I'm sure no one in here can relate to that, especially coming up in my era. But anyway, so that was kind of one of the attractions. So anyway, we left Waco, Texas, and went on out to San Francisco Bay Area, and I lived out there almost 20 years. I raised my son out there, did my thing as a professional woman. I was a nice little mommy dear. My son graduated high school out there. But in the meantime, from 30 on, started the recreational use of left-hand tobaccos and things. Still not like an alcohol at all. And then, when I was in my 36, 37, somewhere in there, then the tobacco supply kind of dried up. And they started bringing out those little rock things, you know. Some folks say they're rock stars and all. That started getting on the scene out there. So with the tobacco drying up, the rocks were coming out, and I didn't know anything else to do but kind of start sipping on Little Jack and Little Bud. Well, actually, I started with the little wine coolers. By the end of my drinking, y'all, wine cooler was an insult. But, like, why? Calories, calories, and no buzz. Forget that. But anyway, so I started substituting right in there in my late 30s, I guess, 37-ish or so, started drinking a little bit more. But again, this is real social. Folks are coming over on weekends, whatever. The party was always at my house on the weekends, which was okay thing because most of the couples, two or three couples that we kind of bonded with, had children. We all were raising the same kids. We'd all get in there and play dominoes, cards. The kids had a room set up for them with the movies, the videos, and that's just how we partied. I was not a party woman hanging out at the bar or anything. Never got sloppy drunk out in, well, bars in public and dragging different folks home. I always knew who the man was. I told y'all I couldn't marry but three times, so I guess I had to stay monogamous. But anyway, so that was kind of the way it went. But as I got down into my late 30s, I started picking up alcohol a little bit more. And I do have to share that, and I was sharing with a friend this morning, kind of sharing my story with her, right in there too, I was afforded, and I truly count this as a gift from my God, I was afforded an opportunity of, God, I don't know, at least a month, 3 weeks, a month or so of enough money, time, son in Corpus, I'm sorry, down here in Texas while I'm in California, so I didn't have a child or anything to indulge myself in any kind of mind-altering chemicals that I wanted to do. And I did. And during that little mind-altering chemical experimenting kind of time, little alcohol, not a bunch. Husband looks at me one day and says, you need to quit. And I said to him, you're right. We need to quit. We're going through a whole lot of money here, and whatever, and all of those things that I'd heard or seen other people doing this weird stuff were starting to happen to me. You know, the paranoia, peeping out of the windows. He'd go off to the store and stay 3 days to go down to the corner store. I'm stranded because now we don't have two cars anymore. He's totaled his truck. Now he's driving my car. I'm stranded. Me, the dog, Jack, and whatever else was in the house. But anyway, so that was a bottom for me. And he said, stop. But what I know today is when he said we need to stop, what I did was I totally, completely, and fully substituted alcohol. That's how I weaned, as the big book says. We go from one to the other to the other. So I left all those other things along, and that's when I got into my drinking. 38-ish, 9-ish, somewhere in there. Then I started using alcohol to definitely soothe my soul. Because, again, y'all, I'm living with an active addict and alcoholic in my life. So when he'd go off to the store for 3 days or whatever his trip is, the committee's going on, wonder who he's with, what woman here, you know, all those crazy thoughts, I would let Jack and Bud, and if those of you that are not familiar, Mr. Daniels and Mr. Weiser is who I'm referring to right now. Okay, Jack Daniels, Bud Weiser. And I would let them kind of soothe me through the night or help me to go to sleep because I'm sitting up kind of worrying. I wonder if he's okay. And as I did that, I was starting to change how I felt. It was definitely helping me to go to sleep. And when I look back on that, I was starting to do that every day, every evening, every night, every evening. It became a routine. Then it started getting into the weekends because when I'd awaken on Saturday morning and he left Friday evening to go to the store and hadn't quite made it to the corner store when I woke up Saturday morning, I'd start discussing it with Mr. Daniels again. We'd start out early on Saturday morning and we'd discuss quite a long time till he came home. Then when he got home, of course, then we would join together and we would do our little drinking together and we'd party together. He was a nice man, okay? Wasn't nothing wrong with him. He just couldn't find the store. That was his major problem. So anyway, but with that, I'm soothing myself, and I'm using alcohol to change how I feel. And I know this. And it started to get, like I said, consuming alcohol every day. I'd go to school. I usually worked in an educational setting at that time. And I'd go to work, do my thing, pick my child up, come home, start my thing, start my routine every evening, weekends. That's when I'm drinking. Then, at the age of 45, I relocated back to Texas. My aunt that I'm talking about was asking or wanting me to be home, be a little closer to her because I'm her daughter and she was aging. She was fine, perfect health. She just died of natural causes in old age, at the age of 93, 94. But anyway, but she wanted me to come closer. So son is graduating high school. My aunt that I call Nani is saying, please, I wish you were closer. My son wants to go to Prairie View A&M College or University here in Texas. So that was just a natural transition. I will mention, too, that during this little bit of a time that I did have to, and I'm going to put this in quotes, divorce my husband. I filed all the paperwork and I did what was necessary. And I thought I was legally divorced for 3 years while I was out there. And so I left him out there, and I relocated to Texas. And I've been back home to Texas since 1994. Well, in the meantime, I'm drinking every day, guys. I'm doing the same routine. And I'm in an educational setting, so that means that, Mulaney, when that school bell and school is out, in Texas it was earlier, May, whatever it was, boy, the party was on until school started in August, whatever, daily, because I didn't have anything else to do but be on vacation. And I did that. And I did not realize that I was slowly crossing that line into the addiction or the disease of alcoholism. And so I continued to do that, and I remember when it finally happened to me, I was approaching the ripe young age of 50. And the drinking pattern was there. I'm dealing with my aunt. And when it came to Monday morning and it was time to go to school, go back to work, and be an itinerant in my position, I go to different schools, and it started getting that on Monday morning, y'all. I was tired. I was physically worn out, dragging all my little speechy stuff to go work with the little children and all. And I'm like, shit, I'm tired. Is this what happens when you turn 50? Must be the approaching of 50 years old. Never thought it was the alcohol, okay? So I go on, and I start getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. Didn't quite know that, but I was. I'd come home in the afternoon and say, you know, today I'm not going to drink that beer today. You know, I'm just going to go over there, visit with Nani and everything, and be done, and go to bed. And I'd do good, y'all. 9:30, 10 o'clock, I'd come on back to my house. I'm living right next door to my aunt. I'd come back to my house feeling good. I have accomplished not drinking when I first came home. So then the old disease says, you did good. Let's have a cold brew on that one. I said, okay. So I'd go have that one cold brew. That ended up being another cold brew. And this is all through the middle of the week and everything. And I would usually, that was kind of my routine, guys, just on a daily basis. And then it finally got, you know, I said, geez, I am really getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. Physically, I'm healthy, but I was tired, you know, and it's hard work in a sense. Drinking from Friday when you get off work and sipping all day long and, you know, and your beer gets hot. So I don't like hot beer, so I got to hurry up and drink it fast before it gets hot. And then I need to pop another one. And so, I mean, this was just this madness, this insanity. And so I finally decided, no, I didn't. That's when my God stepped in. But before that, I will say this. I remember very distinctly going to that refrigerator and reaching for another beer. And I remember that feeling, that thought deep in my soul that says, Olga, you cannot not take this beer. And before that, I'd kind of rationalize and tell them, oh, yeah, I can, and I'd go on about it. But that particular night, I remember that so doggone distinctly as I kept on and I reached for that beer. And I did. And that started to disturb me just a little bit that I, intelligent, well-educated Olga, could not take that next drink, you know? So thank goodness I had God in my life and didn't know he was working for me, because at this time, religiously or spiritually or whatever, I just kind of put some things to the side. And I'll get into that because I'm going to zip through the steps real quick. But so I wasn't at a stage in my life where I could say, God help me, because nothing had happened. I am one of those not yetters. I've not had any trouble with the law. DWIs, Lord knows I should have, because good and gracious life, I sure did go around that corner, try to get that last beer, make sure I had my drink. But I was just, but for the grace of God, guys, I did not. And so had no problems with any of that. And it finally got to a point that my God said to me, he says, you know what, girlfriend, you got a heck of a good health plan. Why don't you make a phone call? So I did. I called Scott and White over in Temple. And the lady answered the phone, and I had my nice little Miss Rogers professional speech all ready to tell them what I needed from them and how they probably possibly could help me. And she said, hello, blah, blah, blah. I identified myself, and all that could come out of my mouth is, I am tired of drinking. And she said, please come on down. And I said, thank you, ma'am. Now, here comes Olga again. I'm going to schedule my appointment with you according to my schedule. This is in February, and I run off a nice little palm pilot. I can pencil you in, Scott and White detox, at this point here. But the lady said, we're going to wait. Let's see. The first opening is, let's see, I sobered up on the 15th. That was my first sober day. So I must have said on March 14th. I'm like, well, now, go and have a discussion with the lady. But he said, this is when you're going, so I went. And the way that worked out for me, that was one of the first miracles, in a sense, to me in my life, because I'm in an educational setting. Nobody really realized, I didn't think, nobody really knew that I was drinking like I was drinking, because I did not come to work, I don't think, loaded no time that I can remember. But anyway, this March date that I have hits right smack dab in the middle of spring break. So I went and made my appointment. I went to observation. The counselor knew exactly how to talk to me because she said, well, now, Ms. Rogers, we would love to observe you for 2.5 days in the hospital. She didn't say that it was the psychiatric ward. She did not say it was detox. She just said, we would love to observe you. And I had been saying for a long time to myself that I wish somebody would, not literally, but it was literally, lock me up for a whole day so that I could prove to myself that I could go that whole day without having a drink. I used to think that in my head, but I don't know that I probably didn't say it out loud. But Jack and Bud, they knew. I told them about it. So that's who I told about it. So anyway, when this lady says to me, we need to observe you, then it was like an answer to a prayer because I knew in my soul that there was no way in the world on my own power, not having those words then, could I not drink. So that was the 14th, and I went in for my little interview and everything, and then the next day was the 15th, and it was all I could do, guys, all I could do not to just get good and sloshed. I've heard people say, well, I'm going in. I knew I was going in such and such a day. I did my last drunk, da, da, da. I was trying to be present myself in an appropriate manner when I went in. I did not want to go up in that toe down, okay? So I went back home, and I shared with my aunt a little bit because she was a very proud woman, and we didn't have any alcoholics or anything in our family, okay? So whatever I said to my aunt, I let her know I was going to go to the hospital because she would have had a cat if I wasn't there. So anyway, so that's what I did. I managed to have only approximately 3 to 4 beers that night or that day. And when I awakened that next morning, one of the most trying things for me was not to pop that top before I drove myself to Temple Scott and White. That was truly an effort, and that was one of the first miracles for me because it just kind of went along. So I went to Scott and White. I was observed. I was running stuff, trying to help somebody fill out a resume and encouraging other people to do things. Oh, yes. I'm the only one that was an alcoholic in there. The other people were there because of mental, you know, issues or whatever. So I'm there saving the day and everything. God. Well, the guy got a good resume out of it, and I told him, go get a job. So I don't know who the poor man was, but anyway. But I will say this. While I was there, there was a gentleman by the name of Lloyd. He talked to me. He was an alcoholic in recovery, but was there because of mental health issues. And Lloyd talked to me a little bit about AA. He probably did. I didn't know what y'all was talking about then. I was just up in there helping folk and telling them I didn't need to go to the, you know, those art class, those groups they wanted you to paint and draw stuff. I'm like, y'all, what is up with this? I can run this class, okay? And they just, oh, God, I would love to talk to some of those people now, but I'm sure they know my kind. But Lloyd talked to me a little bit, and I remember that Lloyd, on that Thursday night, the members of a local group there of Alcoholics Anonymous brought a meeting in to Scott and White. And he told me, he said, Olga, you need to go to that meeting. It's an AA meeting. And I looked at him. He says, you need to go. Okay, I follow the rules. So we went. He went with me. We sat in that meeting that night, and there were, to the best of my memory, there were two guys that came and brought the meeting in. There was me, and there was Lloyd. They said whatever y'all say when you come in and try to share experience, strength, and hope. I don't know what the heck they all said. All I know is they offered a desire chip. And Lloyd, sitting next to me, gently took my hand and whispered, he says, you need to take one of those. And he just moved my hand over. The gentleman put the chip in my hand. And but for the grace of God, that's the only desire chip that I've had to pick up since I've been in these rooms. The reason that I tell this part of the story is that once I got out of observation, and since I have been pretty active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and service and lots of things, I've gone to Gatesville and all, nobody in Gatesville, Pioneer Group, or anywhere knows anything about a Lloyd. And it came to me that that truly had to be an angel that was there just for Olga, but that did that, because if he had not been there, I don't know if I'd have gone to the meeting or not. If they'd have said go, I would have gone, but I wouldn't have known. I didn't know what you guys were talking about. I was just a bit fuzzy, guys, just a bit at that time, and I would not have even, that was my start, and I'm so grateful that God put Lloyd, a.k.a. Angel, in my life at that point. So I left there, did the outpatient treatment thing, everything, and they told me, as part of this program, you got to go hang out with those folks at Alcoholics Anonymous 3 times a week. And I informed the counselor, as I whipped out my little calendar, that I really don't have time to do that. And, of course, he was in recovery. He did, you know, share that much with me. And he smiled at me and said, well, Miss Rogers, that's part of it. Here's your little card. Didn't give me a piece of paper. Gave me a little card. And please have this signed when you go to those meetings. And I'm like, wait a minute. I've really got a busy schedule, sir. However, I did want to participate and follow the rules, and I didn't want to flunk outpatient 101. So I did the extracurricular activity. And I am grateful for that because at least that particular program there at Scott and White helped me to know intellectually that Olga is an alcoholic. Olga does have the disease, the addiction, or whatever. It is a teaching hospital. Residents had to come in every Thursday and do a presentation of what alcoholism does to the brain or whatever they did and to the body. And, of course, the nerd that I am, I took notes. I drew the little sketches and everything. And I was convinced in my head that, yes, I am an alcoholic. But when I came in here with you guys and I sat my butt down and he put the cotton in my mouth, took it out the ears. He did. And I listened. I heard the sameness of every one of us in this room. And that happened early on for me. And I kept coming back to the rooms because they said I had to come 3 times a week, y'all. So I hung out with y'all. But I was able to listen, and I was open-minded. Well, I didn't know I was open-minded. I wasn't all that open-minded. I was just listening and being polite and taking. I used to take notes, too. Big James, I don't know if you remember back in the day when I used to make those meetings. I used to come in there with a notepad and taking notes, and one of our gentlemen that has lots more years than I do one day politely said, Olga, you might not want to take notes. Some people might not like you doing that or whatever he said. Because I'd take notes. I wanted to know what you were saying. I'd have to come home and research your little slogans. And I wrote down the pages of all the prayers. And I did all that good stuff. But anyway, and I remember that my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in Temple. It was at night. I'm blanking on that 8 o'clock meeting. Not Serenity. Tim Bell. The Tim Bell group. They let us out of the group early, 15 minutes, and we were to caravan together from Scott and White to the meeting in Temple. So, of course, this is still part of the course, so I must go. So I did, and I'm very grateful that I did. And I sat there at first, and I looked around, because y'all were, you know, how we come to a meeting and whatever we got on, because Lord knows we drank and whatever we got on. But I had on my Miss Rogers suit, and I was very professional. And I looked about, and this gentleman over here was spitting in that cup, that spitting stuff, and just doing all these things. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, do I belong here? It took me about that long, though, literally. I'm being a bit facetious, but it took me about that long to listen. And I heard the hole in the soul. I didn't quite hear the hope. I didn't hear the upside right then. All I was identifying with then was the sameness as that hole, that loneliness, that all those things. Somebody said they never did fit in, all those things. And I just kind of sat back and I just looked. And the other thing was, it was the first place that I was felt at home. A lot of us say that when we come in here. I was at home. It didn't matter. Y'all came, you hugged me. It didn't matter that I was intelligent or black or purple or had on polka dots or whatever the deal is. You hugged me and you said, just keep coming back. It gets better and better. And I did. And I kept on doing that. And after my little outpatient thing and my required 3 times a week, from that point forward, I have just delved into the program to the best of my ability with Alcoholics Anonymous. And That's pretty much how I got here. I sat in the rooms. Fortunately for me, it came up on summer break, right after outpatient, so then I could make the... I didn't hear nobody say nothing about 90-90, but I made those meetings. I went to... My friend over here, Cecil's, was at Primary Purpose at that time. That's where I sobered up in that group. 12 o'clock meeting every day. They opened the doors. I was present. Whenever y'all opened the door, I came and I sat down and I listened. It took my notes, of course, but I was listening to y'all and everything. And that's when I started listening. And then they said something about you need a sponsor. First challenge to the intelligence. So I looked at these steps and I said, I can understand these steps quite well. Thank you very much. All right. But again, my higher power was working for me because he very politely did something that made me reach out and ask a lady. She's in the big meeting in the sky now, Sheila Gould. A lot of people know her, yes. I walked up to Sheila, and I asked her if she would sponsor me. I remember that afternoon, that evening there over there on 23rd Street in Waco, Texas. And she looked at me, and she said, yes, I will do that. And later on, after I'd been in, I don't know if I'd been in program a year or whenever, however long I'd been, but she introduced me one of the first times that I ever shared my story. And when Sheila introduced me, she had never told me this. She says that when she first met me and I went to Heart of Texas Group, just making those three meetings a week, I had my little notepad and all. She thought I was a student observing, and she did not know. And she talked to me a minute and everything and giving me directions on how to be appropriate in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and open meeting and don't go taking all the stuff we're hearing and spreading it about and all that. And I told her, I said, no, ma'am, I said, I am an alcoholic and I have to come because of this. And I showed him a little card. So she was polite and she spoke to me and all. But anyway, I went on and asked her to sponsor me. And when that was what, March, April, May, June, somewhere, probably the 1st of June, around 3 months or so. And from that point forward, y'all, I've been here. Awesome sponsorship. My sponsorship legacy is strong. Sheila did pass away, I believe it was March of 2003, but just before she passed that December and was trying to get back over to England because she knew that she was passing and leaving us, I stepped up and I asked AM is my sponsor now, and dear AM. So I've done what you guys told me. I've kept a sponsor. I talked to my sponsor. I've learned, and I continue to learn. I try to stay open-minded, willing, and I try to remain teachable. And since I've been in here, there have been 49,000 miracles that have occurred. They've got a saying that says, don't leave before the miracle happens. I say, don't leave before the miracles, plural, happen, because I had absolutely no clue all of the great things that would be happening once you get in these rooms. So, very quickly, briefly, because probably y'all ready to eat, some of the miracles, God, some of the miracles, learning to live this program, that was the most awesome thing that for me, because this program and these 12 steps and these spiritual principles is a design of living. It's not about checking off the little checks. Step one, step two, step three. Thank you very much. I've done all of that. Don't need any more. Maybe I'll take a little step 11, maybe not. Maybe a little step 10, all of that. I took them in order, and I say take. I have a gentleman in my home group that says that we don't work them. The book says these are the steps we took. And what comes to my mind and my understanding is that as I take or took step one, I internalized it. Yes, I am powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. And there's a spiritual principle, honesty, that's attached to that. So the minute I took that step, the spiritual principle of honesty kicked in to the best of my ability. And goodness knows I am not Miss AA, queen, or perfect, or none of the rest of it. But I started to learn how to do that principle and try to apply it in all of my affairs gradually. And each one of those steps, each one of those spiritual principles, that's how I've been taught to learn to live this program. And that's what works for me today, one day at a time. Financial insecurity, and I'm going to start jumping around now. Financial insecurity is one of the one of the things, one of the promises that comes through that's mentioned in the book there, right, after step nine. But that was a biggie for me. Made nice money, but I just tripped because I could, I guess. You need to talk to Jack and Bud because this house note's coming up. No doggone well, automatic deposit in the bank will occur day before the note's due. You just write the little check or whatever the deal. But I had to trip on that and talk to Jack and Bud about all that. Just get stuck on hold. I know today that all those kinds of things, I used to say stuck on hold. You guys helped me to know that underlying all of that I was fearful, straight up fear. And since I've been here, I have learned to exchange that fear for faith. I'm going back to the money thing right now because I would like to share a very recent situation with you guys. In the year of 2002, I had a divine vision from the God of my understanding to open a house for other women that are in recovery from drugs and alcohol. Divine vision, y'all, because I got a profession, okay? I wasn't looking for no other kind of job. But that came to me as I was trying to pursue some other things with my speech and hearing. So I did. I just said, okay, and I took the next step, next step, next step. Well, everything was cool with all of that, y'all, until the little nickel that I had in the bank started to dwindle. Kind of doing a little remodeling at the house, had a nice little cushion for me of money, but I'm paying a little dude to do the little painting and stuff, and he's coming to me every Friday, you know, like you get paid on a construction job every Friday. He wanted his pay or whatever they called it, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, this is not quite what I was expecting because my little monies are dwindling. But first piece of me saying I'm willing, God, to try to do your will, so I'm going on with it. I fell on my knees one day that summer of 2002, didn't even have a woman in the house yet, and just kind of said, you know, God, I'm not real sure what's going on here. And even more so, I don't know that I verbalized it, but he knew what I was tripping on. My little nickel in the savings was going away, and I wasn't real happy about that part. And but I just said, I don't know what's going on here, and what's up? Help. And I did whatever talking and praying that I did. I put it in his hands. And literally 15, 20 minutes later, the phone rang. The gentleman called me. He was new in the program. He said to me, he says, Olga, I don't quite know how to reach out and help people like I see that you're trying to do. What can I do to help you reach out to these people? That's the first time. I'm not accustomed to anybody really reaching out to me or that. So I thought, well, my thought is, I need money and I need it bad. But I'm not going to say that part. And the gentleman just passed away this past week, y'all. And I didn't know. I heard that he was a hardware person, owned a hardware store. So I'm trying to think now. Maybe he could give me some nails or some paint or something like this. But I already had all that, so I didn't really need that. God spoke through me, and I said to him, I said, some money would be nice, sir. And he said, how much? And I don't know what my mouth said. If I said $1,000. And he just told me, meet me at a meeting, 12 o'clock. And I did. He says, my only requirement or my only request is that I remain anonymous. So I met him. He stepped outside that meeting before the meeting started, and he put a wad of cash in my hand. Stayed for the meeting, went home, sat there and did my bills out. The cash I had in my hand added up to $3,000 cash. My bills added up $2,999 and some odd cents. And all I could do was just look up. And from that moment forward, I have walked through any kind of fear. You just don't even trip but a half a second, because I know today that if I exchange that fear for faith, my God's got my back. And as long as I'm doing what my God asks me to do, as long as I remain willing, he will handle it. When I get that little stir in my stomach, Olga is trying her best to dip up in that stuff. Oh, God, she is. I want to go back to this gentleman because he did pass last week. Last Tuesday night, we were sitting outside at the Recovery Hope House. That is the vision. It is called Recovery Hope House. I was able to open it, start it, whatever, July of 2002. Today I have some ladies here that are residents there. I have one lady here that is two ladies actually that are alumni of Recovery Hope House. Not Olga. God runs that house. I don't. We were sitting out in the backyard last Tuesday. We have a 6:30 women's meeting on Tuesdays. And if you ladies want to come to Waco and get a good women's meeting, we'd love to have you. We were out in the backyard having a meeting. And I felt this gentleman's spirit. And he said to me, it's okay now that you can break the anonymity of who I am. So I did. I told the ladies because they've heard the story. I've shared the story, but I've not shared a name. So I told the ladies that were right there at that meeting. His name was John Keith. I said, the gentleman that just died, because we were kind of talking about going to his wake or trying to, you know. I said, that's the gentleman. The other piece of the miracle to me is the wake was this past Thursday. And because of my crazy schedule, I wanted to go past. I would not be able to go during the assigned time. So I went by, totally off my schedule, wasn't on my palm pilot. I went in about 1:15, 1:30, into the funeral home. His family were sitting there observing, looking at the video or something, kind of making the final arrangements. I went in and I thanked John. I thanked God for putting the man in my life. And then I got to talk to his wife one-on-one. And I told her what her husband and that gift and what he did, what that did for me. Recovery Hope House, yes, but for me. And I shared with her. I said, that act or that God worked through your husband to help Olga to know that I can truly, that step three, turn my will and my life over. I can turn everything over to my God. I said, he worked through your husband to let me know that. And since that day that your husband put that money in my hand, I have not had any financial fears since. And she just stood there with tears in her eyes. She thanked me because she knew, of course, he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew all of that. But I could see that she did not know that he had done that. And so I shared that with her. I said, I just wanted to share that with you to know that he is truly an angel. And then, of course, some of the ladies went from the house to the service and whatever, and they were able to meet the wife, the son, and the daughter. And they said that this is your husband's legacy here. These ladies here, this is what your husband has done. These are the people that you've helped. Olga didn't do nothing. All I did was say when I got that notion back in 2002 and I did not pass the hearing aid dispensers test in the state of California, I said, God, if I pass the test, cool. If you don't want me to pass it, cool. I missed that test by 2 points, and it immediately flipped into, you need to go home and have a recovery house, girlfriend. And that's what I did. God runs my life today. I don't. There are so many miracles that have occurred and that continue to occur in my life today. So many. And I think one of the most, rewarding things that I do today is being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Kind of started it. I do service work. Started it at Humility, the home group. Still do. Then I kind of got drug into the district level. I am the current DCM, if you please, for our District 91. Don't know what's happening. That service manual's still written in part Greek. I don't know what it's doing. I don't know. They didn't teach me Greek at Baylor, y'all. I took Latin, but they didn't put Latin in the service manual. But anyway, so what I do today is I try to share what this program does for me, shares with me, and I say to every woman that I work with, or anybody that'll just be still enough to listen to me, that number one, recovery is a gift. But for the grace of God, grace is a gift. Grace is something that I don't care. I can't do anything, pay your money, turn a flip, anything to get you to give it to me. I can't do anything for a grace. And this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, recovery, it is truly by the grace of God, my God. I am so, so grateful for this whole thing. I never knew that life could be so beautiful. You know, I just didn't know that it could be so beautiful. I'm happy, I'm joyous, I'm free. I have contented sobriety today. I have peace of mind. I don't have any mental trips going on no more. That little committee fired them a long time ago. As long as I let God handle the door to the conference room, everything is cool. I've got peace of mind. I got peace of emotion. My emotions don't trip today. I know what my moral standards are. I know who Olga is today. I know those seven parts of self because y'all taught me, or Sheila helped me to see those seven parts of self. When I get my want to get disturbed, all I do is walk back and say, okay, Olga, what part of you, what part of self is being disturbed? Because folks going to keep doing what they're doing. You know, peace of mind. I have peace of emotion. I have peace of soul, of spirit. Because of this program, I have a God of my understanding today that I am very, very close to. I don't have that little trip I used to have because I'm the only Catholic in my family. My uncle is the good Baptist minister of a big Baptist church in Waco that says I should play the organ for them. My uncle over here is a deacon in the AME church, and I need to go there. This one's saying black folks saying Catholic, so you ain't even supposed to be a Catholic. I mean, all that confusion, all of the stuff that was going on around religion, it doesn't happen for me today because this program has led me to a God of Olga's understanding. I can sit in any one of y'all's church houses, if you please, and you can worship however you want to worship because I'm at peace with me. I know who my God is, and I'm okay with that today. I'm okay with Olga today. And as I was sharing with somebody, I've learned this, and I'm going to shut it down. I've learned that it is not my business what you guys think of me. Absolutely not my business. But it is my business of what I think of you. Because if I am living the spiritual principles associated with those 12 steps, also practicing tolerance, acceptance, patience, love, all those things, if I'm trying my darndest to stay focused there, to stay focused on my God's will, and walk my little walk here, it ain't just right here. I don't have time to be tripping on what you think, that you don't like the way I got my hair today, okay? I am so sorry, okay? You should have seen it this morning, y'all. But anyway, that's the gift, because I wasn't that way when I got here, and I wasn't okay with the religion thing. I wasn't okay with the Bible thing, all of these things, but I can let you be who the heck you are, and I love you just the way you are. And if you love me the way I am, cool. If you don't, oh, well, talk to your sponsor if you're in the program. And if you're not in the program, you might want to check out the 12 steps anyway, because they work real well for all of us. Anyway, I don't know what all I'm saying right now, except that it's truly an honor for me to be up here to share my story with you guys. I am so grateful that you guys were here to listen. I'm so glad for all of you folks in this room. Old Cecil over there that taught me about a toolbox way back in the day. All of you guys that were here that kept sharing experience, strength, and hope to help Olga learn how to do this deal one day at a time. Life is good. If you haven't given it a chance, you ought to. And in my best Baylor vernacular, it gets gooder and gooder. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thanks, Paul.
We have a, is that marijuana? Scared the hell out of me for a minute.